Hello, friends and folks, and welcome back to another episode of the Gimmick Awards from Scanline Media. I'm Six Detmar.
And I'm Jennifer Uncle.
And for today, we are here to talk about the best moment in a game in 2019. You know, sometimes shit happens in games and you're like, that's cool.
Indeed. Or sometimes something happens and you start crying for a little bit, which also happened to me this year a few times.
So we will have some spoilers in this section. I think specifically I will say we will probably spoil Outer Wilds, and I'm guessing we're going to spoil Kingdom Hearts 3.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about the ending itself too specifically, but there's a moment within the ending. Not the ending, but that basically the fights that are leading up to the ending that really affected me, so I thought it'd be worth calling out here.
Like anything in Kingdom Hearts, it needs about 3 or 4 layers of being like, well, the thing you need to understand is, so that's good. You can't just say spoiler warning. You have to be like, well, not like a real, but like kind of a pseudo-spoiler. Yeah. No. Okay. But, Jen, can you read off our little list here?
Sure thing. So we have skipping a cutscene in Death Stranding, making Dong Shuo beg in Total War 3 Kingdoms, the ashtray maze in Control, calling your mom in a short hike, the quantum moon in Outer Wilds, figuring out what's wrong, Outer Wilds, the Mikiri counter in Sekiro, dropping on the train in Apex Legends, that fucking Kane guy from Judgment, having a good group cry in Kingdom Hearts 3, and reading poetry in a fight from Devil May Cry 5.
Yeah, a lot of, like, not a lot of chaff on this list. These all, I think, are pretty good entries. Some of them are more like individual moments, and some are more like a type of moment that recurs, obviously. Like, dropping on the train in Apex Legends is kind of, for me, it is the height of getting back into Apex Legends and realizing that, like, I basically just always, at the start of the thing, want to drop on the train, and if you survive that initial scramble, you're going to have a good game. It's just, there's something really special about, like, I mean, there's always that initial rush, but, like, I don't know, you play out Fortnite or PUBG or something, and the lower power level overall means that you are, sometimes you drop hot, and it's like, okay, this person has a gun and I don't, and I die, right? Whereas in Apex Legends, of course, there are times when you don't get a gun, but it's you have so many more resources, and the power scale is so much higher that, like, especially dropping on the train, you're basically guaranteed a gun. It's just sort of the question of, like, okay, I got, you know, a pistol, and this person got a fully kitted out assault rifle. This is gonna be fun. Or, you know, like, the fact that you're always doing it in squads, it's like, okay, I have a particular skill at landing on the train, and so all three of my teammates are here. Maybe only one of you fuckers made it. You may have a gun, but good goddamn luck. I don't know, it's an encapsulation of what I like about Apex Legends, about that like chaos, but also that it the time to kill and the way fights happen. I basically never in that game feel like I'm dying before I understand what's happening and can do something about it.
Totally. And it's the train is an improvement from the first map where when we tried to land on something specific in that first Apex Legends map, it was always the blimp that's flying overhead, which does move a little bit through the train. But if you get on the train in Apex Legends, it can become a real race to see whether you can ride the train out of the danger zone like we did in that one game together, or whether you have to abandon it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a good point, I remember, where we were the three of us were on the train. We had successfully conquered the train, and we were like, okay, this is fine, it's going to ride into the circle. and we saw the wall approaching, and we're like, it's probably going to make it. We're like, I don't know if it's going to make it, but like, if we jump off and run by foot, it's definitely not going to be faster, so I guess we just sit here and hope it works out. There's a really great tension there.
Yeah, and it just made it by a hair, which felt amazing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this terrible strategy we put out ended up panning out after all. Let's see.
So we can probably cut the Mid-Curie counter in Sekiro. I think that's one of the best feeling things in a game that has really good feel. The Mid-Curie counter, for those who aren't aware, is for most people the first, like, the first upgrade you're gonna get. Where if someone does a thrust attack with you with a sword or a spear, you can like dodge and like step on their weapon and pin it to the ground. And just like the impact of that move and how screwed someone is when you land it just feels incredible. But it is, you know, it's just a move.
And that part where you, like that one boss you were having trouble with on stream, where when you Mid-Curie counter him successfully and you just stomp his spear into the ground, that feels so good.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of enemies, like, have a great, like, the animations in Sekiro are so great. Like, after you Mid-Curie counter a lot of enemies, their next attack, they are visibly angry because of how disrespectful that was. and it's very good.
Another cut that I feel like should probably be done pretty close to the start here is skipping a cutscene in Death Stranding.
I guess you're probably right. The thing about skipping a cutscene in Death Stranding is it's like the story in Death Stranding fucking sucks, right?
Totally.
But you're there and you're like, listen, I don't want to miss, you know, like maybe it's going to get better or whatever. I mean, this is what I paid for. This is why I'm here. And skipping a cutscene is not just skipping a cutscene. It's the moment where you realize, I don't care anymore, I'm free.
So it's like a I'm over this bullshit moment then.
Yeah, it's maybe I should title the moment breaking up with Hideo Kojima. Yeah, no, I don't think it does make the list, but yeah, it's a great moment when you're like, wait, I don't care. Oh, that's great, I don't care. I think it's wonderful.
There were times when I wanted to skip for sure, or at least thought about how, oh, if I had skipped this moment, then I wouldn't be hearing this character talk about how she lactates for her ghost baby a second time.
Yeah, no, I think the first time I skipped a cutscene was the Fragile explaining her name one, and I was like, no, I'm good. I just hit start, and then I was off running around carrying some fucking, you know, metal so I could go build another bridge. And I was like, this is all right.
Fragile, but I'm not that fragile, right?
Well, I have heard that before, but I don't know how many times she said it because I just started skipping any time I saw her in a cutscene. Or most people in a cutscene, honestly. I mean, there wasn't a lot. I let Mads Mikkelsen say his piece usually, if it wasn't a repeat. But otherwise, nope, you lost your privileges.
Yeah. It's definitely something I wish I would have done sooner. At least for me, I guess part of the game is seeing how painful some of the writing is. Like, that's part of the experience for me, knowing exactly what this thing is. But overall, it's one of those things where I occasionally regret the time I spent with that, so skipping definitely would have been nice.
All right. Well, let's see. We can probably cut. I feel like we gave our propers to this with the best new character for V. But in the classic tradition of the Vanquish smoke a cigarette button, V has the combat mechanic where, because he's so useless in combat, it's mostly just his pets doing all the work. Very often, the right thing for you to be doing as V is to hold R2 and just bust out your book of William Blake and start reading some fucking poetry. And it's great. I love doing it every time.
It's like it's a... Oh, go ahead.
I said, I feel like it even plays into it that he's such a stupid asshole that he's reading the same poems over and over. Like, initially you'd be annoyed, but it's like, no, this is just his favorite poems. And he's like, well, whatever, I killed the last guy who heard this one, so I can read this to somebody new. They'll never catch me. He's just such a fucking tool.
I love that one Twitter edit where someone puts the hungry little caterpillar in his hand instead of the poetry book.
I do wish there was more, like, I really would have loved it if, one of my objections to V is that I feel like they don't give him enough upgrades in the game, and I would have really loved it if you unlocked new books, and they had special powers. If you're like, oh shit, it's time to read some fucking, you know, like, E.E. Cummings, show those fuckers what's up, that would have been really great.
Sort of like form switching for Dante.
Yeah, yeah. There we go. Have him shout out the name of the poem, of the poet when he hits the button. That would be, you know, very stupid. But as is, I feel like as a character, we gave him his credit, and we can go ahead and cut the moment.
The rest of these feel like pretty hard cuts to me, so. Mm-hmm. I guess one thing we could do, could you describe both of the Outer Wilds moments to me so we could figure out which one is stronger than the other?
I think I know which one is stronger than the other. To be honest, I might put both of them on the final list, though. So, obviously, this is going to be big spoilers for Outer Wilds, a game about discovery. The first one is the Quantum Moon. So, one of the things that you... Outer Wilds is a game where, like, if you know what to do, you could do it on your first run, right?
Yeah, it's like Myst. You know to go around the island, flip the switches, get the pages, and then you can free Atrus super quickly.
Mm-hmm. So, in that style, the game is all about just gaining knowledge. And a lot of the knowledge you're gaining is regards to how quantum mechanics work in this world, right? And basically, over the course of various areas, you learn the various properties of quantum mechanics where, like, the location of a quantum object changes if it's not being observed, or if you are in contact with that quantum object and you are not being observed and are not observing your environment, you move with it and stuff. There are a bunch of these properties, and you put them all together to try and land on a moon called the Quantum Moon. And it's called that because it's an entire moon that, if you're not looking at it, will disappear and just end up somewhere else in the solar system. It can be the moon to any planet. You can, and if you're like, if you're over a planet, I did this many times when I was trying to get to it, is I was over a planet and the moon wasn't there, so I just spun in circles until one time when I turned around it was there.
Oh, jeez.
But then the problem becomes, how do you land on it? Because if it's not being observed, it will move. And it has a layer of clouds. So while going through the clouds, you lose sight of the moon. And you, like, the first time, I accidentally found the first quantum shrine. Because I saw the quantum moon, and I flew towards it. And I hit the clouds, and the moon disappeared, and I crashed into a planet. And I was okay, and I got out, and there was something really cool there. But it was like, what the fuck just happened? That planet just disappeared. And so figuring out how to get there, and then once you do, seeing just the whole deal with the quantum moon, which I don't want to spoil too much of, but like you figure out how to actually land on it through a clever trick. And then once you're on it, as I say, if you are in contact with it, but not able to observe your environment, if it moves, you move with it, right? So once you're on it, you're good. But the state of the moon changes based on what planet it's orbiting. So you're doing stuff to manipulate what world it is currently orbiting to change the environment. And the whole thing is just really cool.
That sounds pretty awesome.
Figuring out what's wrong in Outer Wilds, this is spoiling the game. So, again, another big disclaimer here. I'll see if I can insert a little time skip, because this is just what the game is. So, at the start of the game, you're astronaut going on your maiden voyage, right? You're an explorer of space, and you encounter this statue belonging to an ancient alien race, and it basically makes you caught in, like, a Majora's Mask time loop, right? And so, at the end of 22 minutes, the sun explodes and you're reset back to before you've taken off. And naturally, you're like, well, okay, how do I stop the sun from exploding, right? That seems like you should probably figure that one out. Because, you know, it wipes out all life in the solar system when it goes supernova. That's bad. And so you are going around looking at various stuff and, you know, like learning about the ancient aliens. And eventually you start getting clues where you're like, okay, they have this system. It appears to be like the machine, the statue I encountered is part of a system they built, a super powerful, like, set of machinery that is rewinding time for me, basically. It's more complicated than that. And it's like, but it requires an insane amount of power. And they have a special station they have built, like basically on the surface of the sun to make the sun go supernova. And you're like, okay, I got it. What's happening is this machine is going haywire because the aliens are all dead. This machine is going haywire, causing the sun to go supernova. That burst of energy is enough to send me back in time. So all I need to do is turn this machine off. The sun won't go supernova, and the time loops will stop, and everything will be okay, right?
I'm guessing it's not that simple.
You get to the sun station, and they're like, turns out the machine doesn't work. The sun going supernova is just the natural lifespan of the sun. You can't do anything about it.
Oh.
And so you have this moment where you're like, okay, you need to turn off the machinery that's causing the cycle, and you need to, like, basically solve one last mystery just to have some peace of mind before the end of the universe, because you can't stop it.
Wow, that's a pretty dark ending.
It's really special, because there's this moment, the whole ending sequence is like, it gets into a bunch of stuff about, like, trying to solve this one last mystery and uniting, like, all the other explorers, including the last surviving member of this alien race, who's really cool. She's really chill. And just sort of having, like, basically, like, one last jam session at the end of the universe. And it's really, like, and it's not like a jam session, like, you know, it's not guitar practice. It's just you're sitting around a campfire, like, you know, like, playing, like, drums and guitar as the universe ends. And it's about sort of making your peace with that.
That sounds pretty incredible.
It's the ballsiest ending I think I've ever seen a game do. It's really amazing that they were willing to be like, no, you don't get to save the day. The day does not get saved. The apocalypse happens. And it's just, you know, how do you make your peace with a world that is going to end?
I can see why this game made it on so many people's Game of the Year lists.
Yeah, it's something special.
With all that context, I feel more comfortable cutting the Kane guy from Judgment. It is a pretty incredible action sequence, but I'm not sure if it holds up to everything else here. Like, the whole thing with the Kane guy is that you initially meet him as someone who just has a cane and is trying to kill you with it. Like, I think the first encounter is him unsheathing it like a sword and fighting you that way. But eventually you end up going to his hideout, or at least the place where he's guarding. And you fight a series of boss fights with him. Like, every time you get his health to zero, he runs out of the room and you face him again. Except every time, his cane takes a different form. Like, I think the sword and just regular cane are the first two forms or something like that. And then at some point, you run into him for like the third time, and he takes his cane, flips it upward, and the cane is suddenly a shotgun. And you have to fight him with his cane shotgun. Then you run into the next room, and he shakes his cane, and another cane pops out. So now you're fighting him, and he has... maybe he broke it in half, but the point is, Cane Guy now has two canes, and he's fighting you with them. And it keeps moving from cane form to cane form, and it's one of the best visual gags I've seen in a game that's focused on third-person fighting. Like, it feels closest to the kind of gags you would see in a martial arts movie, like something like Police Story or anything with Jackie Chan, really. And that's just something you don't see in video games for the most part. So seeing it executed so brilliantly in this game with the physical comedy nailed right down, that was something to see. But yeah, I'm looking at everything else on here and... maybe it's not as good as all that.
Well, I definitely think I would cut the Apex Legends dropping on the train for that. That sounds cooler than the train.
Okay.
We can also cut making Dongshuo beg. It's good, but it's just one of those things where in Total War Three Kingdoms, like a lot of these, big strategy games, there's like diplomacy options and the NPCs will open up diplomacy of their own accord and it's according to their personalities. Sorry, my throat's all fucked up. And for Dongshuo, for those of you who don't know Three Kingdoms, Dongshuo is a tyrant and a huge piece of shit. And so at the start of the game, Dongshuo is, ruling over China basically. And almost every turn, he has these he offers you these things where he's like, hey, if you give me all your money, I'll let you be my slave, basically. And you're like, get fucked, Dongshuo. Why are you even talking to me? but also, since everyone hates him, over the course of the game, his position gets worse and worse. And it's hilarious seeing his position slowly change where he's like, okay, half your money. A quarter of your money. No money. You can just work for me. Okay, I'll work for you. Okay, lots of money and I'll work for you. Okay, all my money and don't kill me? And you're just like, keep going. Lower. and it's really satisfying. It's mostly, though, just that I think Total War Three Kingdoms is really good. I don't think it's going to get honored elsewhere in these awards. And, Three Kingdoms has also just in general been a big part of our year, so I wanted to shout it out.
Yeah, it's fun watching it's fun when strategy games mix real world people in them and you get to watch fun dynamics where you get to exact your revenge on an asshole or make them beg for mercy.
I do think probably we should not have both Outer Wilds moments in the top three. I mean, I think they both are good enough, but just for diversity of list, I think we should cut the Quantum Moon.
Okay. Do you want me to explain calling your mom in a short hike in a bit more detail?
That would be useful, yeah.
Okay, so a short hike is a game where you're this anthropomorphic bird character, and... You're visiting a vacation island that one of your aunts owns, essentially. Or at least she she's one of the lifeguards there. And the thing with this island is there's no cell reception except at the very top of this mountain. So the general goal for the game is getting to the top of the mountain so you can make or receive an important phone call that's weighing on your character's mind. And for the most part, everything you're doing around that main objective is pretty chill. Like, you're helping people find their lucky headband to go on a race. You're heading over to the beach and playing stickball with a few friends. You're flying around and going on scavenger hunts, sometimes with a metal detector, other times just seeing how far your wings can take you. But at some point, you are most likely going to go, well, I do want to climb this mountain at some point. And after you climb this incredibly snowy peak, you finally get some bars on your phone and you make the call that you were trying to make this entire time, which it turns out is to your mom. And your character's mom has just gotten out of a very important surgery. And when you're talking with her, she downplays that surgery. Like, she's like, oh, it was always going to be okay. It was just one of those things that I just had to get done. And your character is doing their best not to break down over the phone while talking with her mother and having relief that she's okay, and also just expressing her fears that someday the mom won't be with her anymore. But the mom does what most moms do and is completely reassuring and talks about how great it is that this character is growing up now and is finding her own way in the world. And I happened to play this, I happened to see this moment like a week after my own mother got out of surgery. She had a tumor removed that people thought was, or at least some sort of growth within her body that the doctors thought might be some form of cancer. And in this game were lines that almost word for word mirrored some of the things my mom talked about when I called her to check up on her. Hmm. And there was something universal about seeing that reflected so brilliantly in this game that at the end of this really pleasant short game that really stuck out to me. Like, it was pretty powerful.
All right, that seems like a strong contender. You know what? You'd have trouble. You might be able to do it, but you'll have trouble convincing me as a strong contender. Anything from Kingdom Hearts 3.
So yeah, let's get that out of the way. Kingdom Hearts 3 is a game that is, for a lot of reasons, kind of a disappointment. Because I think partially because they switched to a different engine after working on their own engines for so long. They're kind of learning the new tools. And also just that the plot doesn't really know what to do.
Jen, you can't write good stories in Unreal Engine. It just doesn't, it blocks writing.
But yeah, most of that game's plot happens within the last 5 or 6 hours. But within those 5 or 6 hours, it makes good on something that's been dangling in the series for the last decade or so. Essentially, you finally have the moment where Xion, Axel, and Roxas are back together and fighting alongside one another. And it's a moment that is incredibly powerful because if you played 358 over 2 days, you know that Xion was wiped out of everyone's memory. Like, she was so gone that even the people who were more of the manipulators within Organization 13, completely forgot that she was even a thing. And throughout this sequence where she's reintroduced and starts forming again, like, there's, Axel is going, I know you from somewhere, but I don't know where. And it's like this painful memory that's resurging in both Axel and Roxas's head without them understanding exactly what is happening. And by the time the three of them are together and end up going through one of the Organization 13 fights, at the culmination of that, Sora runs off to get other stuff done. Shion mostly just kneels down and starts crying. And Axel is like, I guess I should have brought some ice cream, huh? But then the moment sweeps over him too, and the three of them just huddle into this, they huddle off to the corner of this arena and start crying real tears together. And that's just something you don't see in a game like this. At least not to this degree. Like, it's such a moment of catharsis, especially when this has been, everything that's happening with both Roxas and Shion and Axel, that's been in the making for a decade or even older if you consider Kingdom Hearts 2 as well. And yeah, it hit me especially hard when I was playing it last year. It hit me harder than even some of the other stuff that happens in the ending, which was also had me, it also got some tears out of me. But that moment in particular, just one of the tallest, cockiest characters in the series, just bending low and crying with his friends, that was something else.
So, I don't want to dunk here, right?
But you're going to dunk.
I kind of am. I have trouble swallowing the drama of anything Shion related, because it's interesting. She was erased from everyone's memory so thoroughly that even the people who created her didn't remember her. You know why that is? Is because they invented her 4 years after the fact. She was retconned 4 years later into a game she would have been in normally, that people would have remembered her. And they're just like, okay, well, we're going to pull a fucking, like, Naruto filler arc, and no one remembered that this ever happened. I don't mind her as a character much. I do think, like, her role as, like, the fourth or fifth Echo of Sora, it's like, oh, this one's the Echo of Sora that remembers Kairi, I think is dumb. But as a character, seeing her interact, I think she's all right. But she's founded on the idea that 4 years after Kingdom Hearts 2, they decided that all of those events happened because of a character they forgot to invent beforehand.
That's a fair point, yeah, if you're just looking at the construction itself. Well, to me, a lot of Kingdom Hearts is construction that's a bit wonky, sometimes falling apart at the seams, but it still impacts you. Like, there are certain things in Kingdom Hearts 3 that happen that are like, this shouldn't be moving me, but this is. And yeah, I think I might have also been slightly affected by the various trans readings of Shion that exist within my friend group. But yeah, I find her an interesting character as kind of an amalgamation of both Sora and Kairi, and kind of figuring out, like, that end scene in 358 over 2 days where her face is shifting into Sora's is incredibly intense, especially. It has a bunch of readings, and several of them are pretty intense. But, yeah. I do think your complaints about it are pretty fair.
Yeah, I guess for me, a lot of Kingdom Hearts, like, everything since Kingdom Hearts 1, and I liked Kingdom Hearts 2, but everything since Kingdom Hearts 1, a lot of Kingdom Hearts can be reduced to, like, moments that are, like, taken in the moment. They're powerful, but looked at with any perspective or context, they are completely unearned.
I don't know if I'd say unearned, but I would say that sometimes it does feel like that. Well, compared to someone like J.J. Abrams, I feel like Kingdom Hearts does better at earning its moments.
But, what? What are we doing right now, Jen? You're like, compared to one of the worst filmmakers of the recent era, Kingdom Hearts is not like a turd on the pavement. Like, yeah, no, I guess that's true.
You're right, you're right. Like, I could go into... I could keep fighting for Kingdom Hearts for a little bit, but I do think that the moment doesn't hold out as well as some of these other moments when examined more closely.
And, like, you know, to be fair, I do, like, that does sound really nice and touching. I just, if it, you know, we're doing top of the year, we have to get it down to 3, and so I'm gonna nitpick the context, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So we're down to 4, and the ashtray maze takes too long.
It does get weirdly hard at the end, too. Like, it has this ugly difficulty spike, though. I think part of it was I'm not very good at controls combat, and somehow the music motivated me enough to make it through the majority, if not all of it, without actually beefing it. But, Yeah, it's one of those cases where I think they even have to... You can hear the song artificially extend once or twice because it's taking a bit longer than they initially anticipated. It's such a cool sequence, though. Like,
it is pretty cool.
It's them cashing in on all of the dream stuff that you see in Max Payne and Alan Wake and some of the more interesting perspective stuff they do in Control, and setting it all to a rock music and watching the room shift almost to the song. Like, sometimes, like, I think it's mostly just to your movements, but sometimes I think I hit a rhythm where it was shifting to the song as well. And that was pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, would you take Ashtray Maze or the Cane Guy?
The
Cane Guy sounded stronger to me, but...
Yeah, I'd say the Cane Guy is stronger in terms of it being... The Cane Guy is more like a cinematic moment because it has, like, his cane transforming into different things has an arc to it, and it goes along with the various fights that you're getting into. It's structured like a fight scene you would see in a martial arts film, so I think that is stronger overall.
It's also stronger in the sense that Jesse Faden was able to clear the ashtray maze. She could never beat the Cane Guy.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
Okay, so are we comfortable with that top 3? Calling your mom, figuring out what's wrong, and the Cane Guy?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that.
I feel like the 1, 2, 3 here is pretty clear.
Figuring out what's wrong, calling your mom, and Cane Guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. Like, calling your mom meant a lot to me, like, personally. Especially the way that it lined up with real-world events, but also Outer Wilds is a combination of everything else that's been happening within it, and to have an ending that is that resolute and unwilling to give an easy closure is impressive, especially since the game trains you over hours and hours to expect to find a solution to everything in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just drops at the very end something that you'll never be able to solve, so you need to find a way to live with it.
Yeah, but you still, like, there's still stuff to do, right? It's not just like it, like, you figure out that you can't and it cuts to credits. It's like, well, no. All right, well, there's something we might as well take care of before the end of the universe. Yeah, it's really amazing. I think the last run you do to get to that is a little bit frustrating. I don't love it. So I actually like, I think if you're breezing through it, then like absolutely finish the game. But I also think it's fine if you want to basically discover all the stuff about what's going on and then watch the very end on YouTube. I think that's all right, because the very last sequence where you're putting together the last little like bonfire like playing session is really cool. But there's like the way you get there is like a timed element where you're trying to do several things in the solar system before the sun explodes, and I just don't like that much at all.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of that bit in The Witness where the super secret puzzle room that is A, randomized, and B, set to a piece of classical music without a real timer attached to it.
Mm-hmm. Not that pretentious, though.
Mm-hmm. From what I've played of it, Outer Wilds definitely handles a large puzzle box better than The Witness.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked The Witness. Like, the moment-to-moment puzzle solving in that and the general way that the world looked was very pretty and nice, but yeah.
There was definitely stuff to like in The Witness. I'm not a Witness fan, but like, there's some really admirable elements of The Witness. Hey, team who worked on The Witness, good job. Jonathan Blow, not a fan, but, you know.
Yeah, in terms of messages being shared, Outer Wilds, far and away, better than The Witness.
What if they were reversed? What if Outer Wilds was a game where at the end you were like, if you're just smart enough, everyone will listen to you and the world will be okay?
The end of The Witness, the end of Outer Wilds being a 3-hour talk with Carl Sagan. And you have to sit there for the whole thing.
And the whole time, the fucking music from The Outer Wilds as the sun is about to explode is playing. All right. Well, that's it for our best moment. Wrapping up the Gimmick Awards here. Only a little bit left. But we'll go ahead and do our proper plug zone. Jen, where can people find you upon the internet?
So I'm at JBU3 on Twitter. Most of my stuff is on scanlinemedia.com or patreon.com/scanlinemedia. We put out a recent novel not due episode on readinggames.online, which is our visual novel book club of sorts. And you could also, if you go to YouTube and search The Realist Scanline Media, we've been doing live streams and Let's Play style content recently, and if you search for specifically The Realist Scanline Media, there was a Scanline Media account, but...
What happened to that one, Jen?
I lost the password for that one. But yeah, just search Realist Scanline Media, and you can find some cool streams and stuff.
Yeah. And I am at SixDetmar on Twitter, SIXDETTMAR. You can find me the same places as Jen. Hope you're enjoying the Gimmick Awards. You should check our site if you want to check out our personal lists. I'm not going to say top 10 because they're personal. Who knows how long they'll be? It might be a top 5. It might be a top 20. We're individually doing them. We've got our own rules. All I know is if you want to know how we felt about this year, if these award categories didn't already give it away, you will know for sure.
Absolutely.
And until next time, folks, peace out.
See ya.